This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank, where here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's a special year-end edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Midterms and Market Basket. While dozens of news headlines competed for our attention in 2014, these two stories dominated week after week. The big question going into this year's midterm elections was control of the U.S. Senate, and one of the highly watched races was in the Granite State, as former Republican Senator Scott Brown moved here from Massachusetts and challenged incumbent Jean Shaheen. It was a contest that drew national interest and money. In the end, Shaheen prevailed.
I am so proud to once again be able to represent the people of New Hampshire in the United States Senate.
But while elections tend to highlight divisions among Granite Staters, the drama over the regional grocery store chain Market Basket this summer seemed to unite people. After the company's CEO Arthur T. Demoulas was ousted by the board, employees revolted. They walked off the job and stayed off, basically shutting the company down until their beloved RDT was reinstated. Here's a Market Basket employee named Sam who called into The Exchange.
You know, he really makes us feel appreciated. He'll come into the stores. He knows a lot of our names. You know, he'll come up to us and shake our hand, tell us we're doing a great job. You know, it's really wonderful to have a CEO that actually cares about the employees as well.
Today in The Exchange, it's a special year-end edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll look back at the top stories of 2014. With us for that is Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for being here.
No problem, Laura.
Also with us, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, good to see you.
Good seeing you, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, let's start off with the year in politics, guys. And Josh Rogers, to you first, what was the overall narrative going into this midterm election year?
Well, as you pointed out in the lead, how would Democrats do? Obviously, second term of a president is a challenge for the incumbent party. President Obama's approval ratings are low across the country, low in New Hampshire. And, you know, Republican enthusiasm was high coming into this election. And Democrats held all the major seats and, you know, control of the New Hampshire House and Executive Council. How is this going to shake out? It was a mixed bag.
Yeah, it was a good election year for Republicans nationally. Josh, just give us a little more, please, here in New Hampshire. Just remind us of how that shook out. Republicans did well in some areas, but not so well in others.
Well, they didn't do well in the big races, with the exception of Frank Gintas returning to Congress. He defeated Carol Shea Porter in their third go-round. Jean Shaheen, you know, beat Scott Brown, and it was a, you know, close-ish race, but, you know, ultimately her margin was pretty consistent with what the polling had been in this race for months. Brown did, you know, narrow the gap towards the end, but, you know, the Democrats, there was a lot of money thrown into this race. Shaheen had very experienced people. She's a candidate New Hampshire voters know well and have tended to favor. Scott Brown did what he could to make this race about national issues, and, you know, he did a decent job doing that, but ultimately, you know, it wasn't enough, and Shaheen's returned to Washington for a second term.
Well, and Dean, going into the midterms, the expectation was, and Josh alluded to this, that big outside money would play a big role. How important was outside spending from outside groups?
Well, there was certainly a tremendous amount of money spent. I'm someone who, you know, I've always been a little bit skeptical about the impact that this money can have on the margins. I think, you know, at some point, the information environment, in terms of campaign ads and other sorts of advocacy group outreach, becomes so saturated. I think particularly we saw in the last couple of weeks voters tuning it out. There's no denying it has an important impact, particularly in comparison to the role that it used to play in the state going back 10 or 20 years. And I think we're seeing it nationally. It's a function of some of the changes that we've seen at the Supreme Court level that makes giving money a lot easier than it once was. You know, one interesting case was the 2nd Congressional District, in which Annie Custer, the Democratic incumbent who went on to reelection, raised a tremendous amount of money. Her opponent, Marilinda Garcia, was someone who was viewed as a rising star in the Republican Party. There was some speculation that there'd be a tremendous amount of money to come in and support Ms. Garcia after she got the nomination. But Congresswoman Custer very quickly with her campaign painted Ms. Garcia as an extremist, using some of her own votes in the state legislature. So there was an example of where we thought money might actually help a challenger, and it just didn't quite pan out that way. But there's no denying it that the outside money is here to stay, both in New Hampshire and nationally.
Yeah, Jeff Feingold, and then back to you, Josh.
Yeah, I think one of the takeaways from this last election was how New Hampshire just in its big races, as Josh refers to them, it didn't reflect what was going on in so many other parts of the country, where the Republicans just swept into, where they took over the U.S. Senate, they increased their majority in the House of Representatives, but in New Hampshire, three of the four races were won by Democrats. And I think what it really has shown is that New Hampshire, at least when it terms in terms of the 2nd district of New Hampshire, is I can't imagine anyone wouldn't say that it's a Democratic district after all these several years of elections we've gone through. The governor, Governor Hassan, did very well in her race. Senator Shaheen, as Josh said, you know, she did better than some people have thought, because Scott Brown he got a lot of money, a lot of backing, and I think it just kind of reflects, as someone. As the editorial writer in the Union Leader referred to, it says it's not Mel Thompson's New Hampshire anymore. I think it really does show that even though they took over the House and they increased their majority in the Senate, in terms of the statewide election, it's a much different state than it was 20 years ago.
But go ahead, Josh.
But on the money front, I mean, it was a lot of money. I mean, there was, you know, $30 million plowed into the U.S. Senate race by outside groups, and not simply on television ads. There was significant investments made by groups like Next Generation Climate Change, Tom Steyer group on the ground game, and money also spent by groups affiliated with the Koch brothers, like Americans for Prosperity. So there's, to some degree, the involvement of outside advocacy and educational groups has increased, but you know the spending was big, and as big as it was in that Senate race, it was still only the 8th most expensive Senate race in the country. And Jean Shaheen did enjoy an edge both in her personal financing and also the outside spending, which surely helped her.
8th most, though, that's a lot. I mean, this is a small state. Right?
Well, but I mean, they're not all states run every year. So.
Sure, good point. Dean.
Yeah, interesting. If you take kind of a step back and look at the bigger picture, there's an interesting pattern that we've seen in New Hampshire and nationally to some extent. You know, in 2008, President Obama won in New Hampshire very comfortably. But 2010, we had the Republican backlash with the Tea Party phenomenon. But then 2012, the Obama coalition came back very strongly in New Hampshire, big victory for Governor Hassan. And now in 2014, we've seen kind of a return of the Republican wave, even though I think Jeff's point is very well taken. There's a lot of data that shows that the underlying partisan dynamic in the state has tended Democratic over the last 15 years. But it has become the case that the demographics of the electorate at the midterm and at the presidential year seem consistently to be very different. So we could be in for a very different kind of election in 16, because there'll be the mix of voters will be fundamentally different than what we saw this past November.
Well, and I want to ask all of you about the legislature and some of the turmoil there recently over who will be leading what caucus there. But I also want to remind everybody that this is a special edition of our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're reviewing the top stories in New Hampshire of 2014, the stories that dominated the news this year. Joining us are Dean Spiliotis. He's author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. So, Josh, as everyone has alluded to, the election results in the New Hampshire House showed sort of a mixed picture. Republicans retook the House, but not as strongly as they did in 2010. What's happening there now, Josh, in terms of this seeming battle for who will control the Republican agenda?
Well, the battle springs from the nominee to be Speaker of the House by the Republican caucus was Bill O'Brien, former Speaker. He edged another former Speaker, Gene Chandler, by 4 votes within the caucus. So when the full House came together to vote on Speaker, Bill O'Brien was the Republican nominee. You need to have a majority. The Democrats had their candidate, Steve Shurtleff. Bunch of Republicans essentially didn't support O'Brien in the first vote. You couldn't get the majority with the Democrats supporting Shurtleff. Sean Jasper threw his hat in the ring. Republican Hudson had been part of O'Brien's leadership team. There had been a falling out there. And he ran as a O'Brien alternative, and it took a number of votes. But ultimately, it was Jasper with the bulk of his support coming from Democrats claiming the Speaker's gavel. This was, a very dramatic day, and no one was predicting this. And it left a lot of the O'Brien supporters feeling quite raw. They had called for a roll call vote on the Speaker's race in order to try to, get the caucus in line. The executive committee of the Republican Party censured Jasper for challenging O'Brien. That has no real effect, but it does show the depth to which this has stirred up the Republican Party. And representatives loyal to O'Brien have been meeting a sort of rump caucus to say that O'Brien needs to be the elected. We need to have an elected majority leader. It needs to be Bill O'Brien. Bill O'Brien says, regardless of what happened, I'm going to be the leader. No one's disputing at this point that Sean Jasper is the Speaker of the House. When the legislature meets to formally vote on its rules, there will be a proposal coming from O'Brien supporters to make the majority leader the pick of the caucus, making it O'Brien, not Jack Flanagan, the lawmaker appointed by Jasper. So, we'll see where this goes. A lot of people who are supportive of Jasper, and even some people who back Bill O'Brien say, once the legislature actually starts dealing with bills and the budget and so forth, some of this will fade. The real staunch O'Brien supporters say, no way. So this will be interesting to watch.
Well, and Josh, we just have about a minute left. But at the State House, you've covered the State House for a long time. Are people saying, wow, we've never seen anything like this before? How are they feeling about all this?
Well, this is a matter of personalities. There's not really much in terms of policies differences that separate the Republicans who back Jasper from the Republicans who are with O'Brien. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out when it comes down to actually doing the business that people were elected to do. This is definitely a strange circumstance. It's not something I've witnessed, and it'll be interesting to watch this one.
All right. Well, we'll be calling on you to help us figure it out in the new year. Thank you very much, Josh, for being with us.
You're welcome, Laura.
Coming up, more of the top stories of 2014. We'll look at some healthcare headlines and a Wolfboro police commissioner whose racial remarks made national news. All that's coming up in this special year-end edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. That's on The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, our special Year in Review edition. We're looking at some of the stories that dominated the news this year. Our guests are Dean Spiliotis and Jeff Feingold. And with us now is Jack Rodolico. He's NHPR's health and science reporter. Jack, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, help us cover 2 big healthcare headlines from the year, both related to the Affordable Care Act. New Hampshire went, Jack, from the dubious distinction of having just 1 insurer on its marketplace to having 5 in the new year. Fill us in on how and why this change happened.
Sure. Well, so In some ways, you know, advocates of the law will say that this is the kind of thing that the law was designed to do, to open up markets like New Hampshire, where you have one insurer that has dominated the market for many years, and, you know, to set up these exchanges to create a sort of platform for other insurers to come into the state. So, you know, one of these new insurance companies isn't quite new. Harvard Pilgrim has been around in New Hampshire in the group market or the, you know, the employer market for quite a while. So they have a presence. But the other ones are very sort of young co-ops and insurance nonprofits. One in particular, Maine Community Health Options, got a lot of funding from the federal government to expand from Maine into New Hampshire. So some of it is market forces, and some of it is really by design of the law that allowed five insurers on the market. And when you look at Maine and Vermont, they're in sort of similar positions, except we now have a lot more competition on that market.
So what do we know about the impact? And I know it's still not all fully in place, Jack, but the impact on healthcare markets and on the number of people who have coverage here in the Granite State.
We know that more people have health insurance than did a year or two ago. We know that the numbers seem to be going up a little bit. It's hard to tell right now because the federal government hasn't released the new numbers for the second round of enrollments. So last year, 40,000 people signed up for insurance on the exchange. It might be more this coming year. It might be the same. We don't know. They're expecting more, but the numbers aren't clear yet. So yeah, so that we're sort of waiting to see. It's a mixed bag so far.
We'll follow up on
it. Yeah,
we'll
talk in January about that.
Well, and before we turn to another healthcare headline that was big this year, Jack, and that's Medicaid expansion, which kicked off. Dean Spiliotis, healthcare was an issue in this year's politics. Some people campaigned in favor of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and some people campaigned against.
That's right. And, you know, I've heard a number of Republican leaders say, you know, that the reality is with a Democratic president in office for two more years, there's no way that the Affordable Care Act could be repealed completely. So the question is what kinds of adjustments might be made. You know, following up on the discussion about the marketplace, you know, I think the hope is that having additional insurers in the marketplace will lead to, you know, greater competition, more inclusion of hospitals in the various networks. But the big issue here is going to be the Supreme Court case on subsidies. There's very specific language in the ACA about who gets to use subsidies to purchase healthcare on the exchanges. It needs to be a state exchange. So we have a hybrid here. So in theory, anybody getting subsidies through the national exchange or a hybrid exchange that's not in an actual state, those subsidies could be subject to withdrawal. So a lot of this is going to hinge on what happens with that Supreme Court case.
Right. I had forgotten about that, Dean. Good point. Jack.
Here's one thing that hasn't really changed so far in New Hampshire is the affordability of health insurance and health care. Those numbers are still going up. You know, it depends on
the
cost of coverage, how much it costs to get health insurance, how much it costs to take care of someone who is sick, or even just, you know, a healthy family trying to afford premiums. That is becoming less and less affordable here and everywhere in the country. There are measures in the law designed to try to put a clamp on that over time, that we're starting to see some penalties on hospitals. We're starting to see incentives for hospitals to think about the quality of care, not the quantity of care. But thus far, you know, it's not making a dramatic impact. And people are really – I'm really starting to hear from a lot of people that are desperately struggling to afford health insurance and health care.
Wow.
And,
Jeff.
And from the business aspect, you know, a lot of businesses have kind of just said to their employees, you're on the exchange now, we're not going to provide you with benefits, and others even thinking about it. And as Jack said, the cost to businesses to provide this health care is still rising. It's going up, and more of the burden is being put on employees who are fortunate enough to have employer-provided health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act is addressing some of the issues, but it's still not the panacea that – well, I don't think most people thought it would be a panacea because it was such a – you know.
It's so huge.
Yeah. But it was looking at the cost. The cost is what really is the major problem with the healthcare system, not only in New Hampshire, but around the country.
One more healthcare story that I did want to follow up on with you, Jack, please, is the beginning of expanded Medicaid. Now, New Hampshire's plan is called, I think it's the New Hampshire Health Protection Plan or something
I
like
that.
I think
that's a little bit of branding.
Yeah, right. But who's covered under this that wasn't before?
Basically, people with a little more money and income than were covered under the previous Medicaid program. And essentially, expanded Medicaid is designed to fill in the gap between what the state previously had for Medicaid and the people that afford subsidies on the healthcare exchange. So it's people who are essentially a little bit above the federal poverty line. And so since it was expanded this past summer, we've seen about the state is expecting over time 50 to 60,000 people to sign up. So far, we've seen almost half of that, over 20,000, and that's faster than they were expecting. So there is clearly a need, and this is happening in rural areas in the cities. There's a lot of community health centers that are just scrambling to sign people up one after another. And it's a pretty straightforward application process. So the state is, moving ahead on this and trying to get, people signed up for Medicaid.
Well, and not to keep bringing up the politics of healthcare, Dean, but it's been a big issue. As from what I understand, when the New Hampshire Republican caucus has been getting together and holding meetings, one of their stated goals is to take another look at this Medicaid expansion.
Yes, I mean, we're hearing quite clearly from the Republican caucus and from Republican leaders that one of the things they want to do is likely stop the reauthorization of this program when it sunsets. That's going to be very difficult when you have tens of thousands of people who now have come to depend on this benefit. This is true in bureaucratic politics and policy in general. Once you create a benefit, it's very difficult to take it back. So it's it's fraught with a lot of potential problems for Republicans if they try to undo this.
Well, it's also not just the people receiving the benefits, but also hospitals themselves.
Sure.
They've been itching for something like this for many, many years, and they instead of getting reimbursed care, they're having patients come in who actually have coverage.
All right. Lots more stories to follow up on this special year-end edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Jack Rodolico, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
That's Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health and science reporter. Again, this is a special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking back at some of the top stories of 2014. And Dean Spiliotis and Jeff Feingold, this next one is a tough one. I want to ask you both a little bit about James Foley, the New Hampshire journalist who was beheaded by the terrorist group ISIS this year after being in captivity. The horrible story here in the Granite State, especially for the Foley family. Here's James Foley's mother, Diane Foley, speaking about her son.
We just kept thinking that somehow we're getting closer. We know he's alive. We just ran out of time. He ran out of time.
Well, and it just breaks your heart to hear from James Foley's mom there. And there have been numerous awards for James Foley, including a new award for conflict reporting. He also got the First Amendment Award here in New Hampshire. So people are really remembering him, Jeff.
Yes, and there's another New Hampshire journalist with New Hampshire ties, with Steve Sotloff, who also
went to private school here in New Hampshire.
KUA, I believe. And it really, I think the media, journalists don't always get the best, have the best reputation, but it's people like James Foley and Stephen Sotloff who make you realize that there are people there who are doing such great work, and I think people do understand that journalists aren't necessarily these guys who just ask rude questions at press conferences, but people who do real work to let us know what's going on around the world,
right.
And they're even willing to sacrifice their lives for that.
Well, and Dean, the issue of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, I'm glad you mentioned his name as well, Jeff, kind of made this issue of terrorism and national security especially raw here in New Hampshire during the elections this year.
Absolutely. We really have entered a new phase of our engagement in Iraq and in Syria as we confront this threat from ISIS. And the James Foley's situation in particular raised some really uncomfortable questions about the issue of whether or not you should pay ransom to people who take hostages. There's a lot of debate nationally about that. Also some concerns about how the family was handled in terms of interacting with the State Department and the government. So there's some kind of real sort of practical human elements to this that we've been focused on. But there also is the larger kind of geopolitical question of this rising threat and the possibility that Iraq is basically going to be potentially blown apart into these kinds of different regions controlled by one particular group, whether it's ISIS or Iran or the Kurds up north.
Well, I want to turn to a story, gentlemen, that in the midst of lots of scary news out there really seemed to cheer people up this summer, Jeff Feingold. And I think you know what I'm going to say. Market Basket. Just remind us of the particulars first in this story, the who, what, when, where, why.
Market Basket is a thriving supermarket chain based in Tewksbury, Mass., and has a very large presence in New Hampshire. Actually, it's one of the biggest employers in the state. In June, the board of Market Basket decided they wanted to get rid of the popular CEO, Arthur T. Demoulas. And it was a family squabble that's been going on for many, many years. And the part of the family that owned 50.5% of the company said, we don't want Arthur T. involved anymore.
This is a long family feud.
It's a very, very long. It's been through many court fights and whatever. But they got rid of Arthur T., as he's known. And out of nowhere, the employees just said, we're not working for anyone but RDT. And then the customers followed suit and said, we're not shopping there until you bring RDT back. It was one of the most amazing things. No one had ever seen anything like that in the United States, let alone around here, that the employees and the customers, non-unionized employees, just decided massively, just we're not going there until you bring them back. And eventually the ownership, the people that owned the 50.5%, the other side of the Demoulas family, they capitulated.
Yeah, it took a long time, though, didn't it?
It took a long time. And it really
– New Hampshire and Vermont.
Governors Hassan and Patrick were involved. It was a major, major battle. It became a national story. Actually, I think I heard a story about it on BBC one day. it was really amazing that in the end, these employees who were sacrificing their livelihoods to do this, they won. And I remember being there the very first day they came back. The smiles on people's faces that they won. The interesting thing is, the most impressive thing about it is that the company is thriving. Even though it's under a lot more debt now because of the purchase of the 50.5% share, but it's a thriving company. They just opened a new store, I believe, in Revere, Mass. It's been killing the competition on so many levels, and it's one of these things where you go, what happened?
And Dean, you know, I remember people talking to me about this all summer. I'd be at a baseball game or I'd be out somewhere and people would ask me about it because I'm a journalist. And no matter what someone's political stripes, no matter what their walk of life, everybody was rooting for these employees. It kind of brought people together.
Yeah, it really captivated people. And I think it shows both workers and consumers that there is actually a recourse against powerful management. But I think this was really driven by the relationship between the Market Basket employees and consumers who were very loyal. If there was really no weak link there in terms of that relationship, which could have undermined it. So just a remarkable example of consumers essentially voting with their feet.
Yep.
Although at some point, and not to put a damper on what you said, Dean, but at some point there was nothing to buy in Market Basket. So even if you wanted to shop, there was nothing there.
That's the other aspect I forgot about. The vendors also.
Right.
Sided with the RDT side.
Right.
They weren't providing a third chain
in the link there.
Yeah. It wasn't just the customers and employees, but the vendors, the people who do business with Market Basket.
Well, this is a special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at the year in review, some of the top stories that we talked about on the Roundup all year long. It's a special edition of the Roundup today. Joining me in the studio is Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, we're especially glad you're here today because a couple business stories that I did want to cover with you, not just the Market Basket, but also a long strike by unionized workers at Fairpoint. What's going on here?
Yeah, that's a big mess. It's actually, in many ways, it's the other side of the coin of what happened with Market Basket. It's a situation where the company's employees have no trust in them. At least the unionized employees have very little trust in the company. They've been really at loggerheads and not negotiating at all. The strike has gone into beyond 10 weeks now. It's really a battle of the company, Fairpoint Communications, trying to get its costs down. Because the unions have what anyone would consider really good benefits. It's 100% health care coverage and that kind of stuff. And these are good paying jobs, well paid jobs. But the problem has been is that the company, by standing up against the union and not negotiating, they've also left the customers in the lurch because there's been many, many claim, you know, people who have really upset complaints about the service in not only in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine. It seems to be something that is just there's no resolution in sight. The governor of Vermont got involved, and it doesn't seem to be moving anywhere.
Well, and there's a Fairpoint office that I pass on my way to work, and you know I see people standing outside picketing. Here's Kelly Tarosian. She's a union member, Fairpoint employee who joined the picketers earlier this year.
All we want is a fair contract and a fair deal. We're willing to give concessions, but what they're asking of us is impossible.
So two sides to every story, of course, Jeff Feingold. But the company has been saying, look, you guys have gold-plated benefits, and it just isn't feasible in today's economy.
Yes, and the company also, in a letter to Governor Shumlin, the CEO, Paul Sununu, wrote that you know that they've claimed that the union is not negotiating in good faith. So we were at a situation where they're both saying they're not negotiating in good faith. There's no negotiations going on, and it looks like it's going to be a long one, much longer than it already has been.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to turn to a story that captured New Hampshire and national headlines earlier this year. This kind of came up out of nowhere, and all of a sudden New Hampshire was being called out for problems with racist comments, Dean Spiliotis. This erupted in this small tourist town of Wolfboro. What happened?
This was Wolfboro Police Commissioner Robert Copeland. He was overheard using a racial slur to describe President Obama in a restaurant, saying that President Obama far exceeded his criteria for this particular slur. Got tremendous amount of publicity. The selectmen were not able to remove him because he's an elected official. They were able to condemn him, however. He eventually resigned, although he didn't exactly apologize. And it started to draw a lot of national attention, people threatening to boycott Wolfboro and the Winnipesaukee region as a tourist destination. And whenever you start to see potential economic impacts, that's when the screws are really tightened. And I think that's when he resigned.
Yeah. How did this spread so much nationally, Jeff?
It's the kind of thing, well, you know, social media does kind of help this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what these people need. That's what people need to really understand when they're even out in public, just thinking, you know, just talking about to your friends or whoever you were talking to. But I think part of it also is as we've seen subsequently in the year, there are some this country still has some serious problems with race relations, racism, and, these things do pop up. It's not as extreme as any of the, you know, police shootings or anything like that, but it is something that really does rub the wound raw.
Well, and one more quick story, and Dean, I'm going to turn to you. Early in the summer, Dartmouth College held an expansive summit on college campus sexual assault. Federal officials were there. It was a big deal. Why Dartmouth?
Dartmouth had been in the news headlines for sexual assault issues. They're one of 55 colleges and universities that were being investigated for how they handle campus sexual assault. They had this summit, and they brought together, as you mentioned, civil rights leaders, educators, forensic experts to try to raise visibility and have an action plan. There had been a protest at Dartmouth in April of 2013 in which classes were canceled. And so this has been going on the campus for a while. As a result, Dartmouth now uses an external investigator and has done increased training for how to collect facts and adjudicate these types of assaults. So they're taking it very seriously.
Okay, well, coming up, we wrap up a few more important stories from 2014, including pipeline problems and the Pumpkin Fest. Stay with us for a special year-end edition Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is a special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking back at some of the top stories of 2014. I'm Laura Kanoy in the studio with Dean Spiliotis and Jeff Feingold. Many of the stories that we covered on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup involved energy policy. With us now on that issue is Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. Sam, thanks for taking time out.
Thanks for having me.
Well, pipelines, Sam, and where new ones might be put in New Hampshire were a top energy story in 2014. What's the big picture here?
So the big picture is that there's simply not enough pipeline to fuel the region during a few of the coldest days of the year. And so last winter, which was a cold year and so somewhat unusual, There were 40 days in which the amount of gas that the region needed exceeded the supply of pipeline that was available. And even though it's only a few days in the year, it really has a huge sort of outsized impact on the electric and the electric rates that customers are paying. And that's because when you get these constraints on the pipelines, the price of natural gas and therefore the price of electricity is just absolutely outrageous. And so you see the impact on you know, it's now trickled down through the wholesale market to the actual ratepayers' bills this year. And basically, you know, that's the question is, how do you deal with what is essentially a peak supply problem? There's not enough to get that peak supply. Most of the year we're good, but then there are those few days.
Yeah, and just remind us of the sort of structures we're talking about, Sam, that natural gas is used for heating, but now more and more used for electricity.
Right. Over the past 10 years, we've had, I mean, literally dozens and dozens of natural gas-fired power plants opening up all through New England. We're now up around, it's over 50%. It's closing on 60% of the region's electricity is fueled by natural gas as a year-round basis. That fluctuates a lot depending on the season. But the point is that natural gas in New England sets the market price for electricity. And so the price of electricity tracks very closely the price of natural gas. If the price of gas goes crazy because there's not enough pipeline, the price of electricity goes crazy too.
Yeah, and people like it because it's plentiful now with the fracking that we've seen in other states. And also that it burns more cleanly, right, than coal and some other sources.
Right. About half the greenhouse gases of coal. And you know, when you look at sulfur and nitrogen oxides, it's much cleaner on that front too.
Well, Sam, I want to play a little piece of sound from someone who's been kind of pushing back on this idea that New England needs more pipeline. That seems to be the mantra that we're hearing from a lot of folks. But here's Environment Northeast's Peter Shattuck saying maybe New England doesn't need more natural gas pipelines.
If demand for gas remains low because of things like energy efficiency, distributed generation, renewable heating technologies like heat pumps and biomass, we may not need any infrastructure overall.
So where are environmentalists coming down, Sam, on this push for more natural gas pipelines?
Basically, I mean, Peter Shattuck summed it up quite well, is that they do think that I would say a lot of them feel that there's probably some room for expansion, but that expansion should track the demand that is called for from the heating utilities. So the heating utilities are saying we need about 500 million cubic feet per day, which is not that much. It's not enough to build the substantial pipelines that people have been proposing. They've been saying, you know, okay, we can make that modest investment, and the rest of the money we should be spending on ways to reduce the demand for natural gas. And of the proposals put forward to build pipelines, they prefer the ones that are expanding existing pipelines as opposed to building new ones.
So they feel, look, let's just focus on the heating end. Let's use alternatives for electricity production.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, and Jeff Feingold, I know you want to jump in too because you've been covering these energy issues.
Yes. I just wanted to say one of the things in terms of the idea of just seeing what, you know, energy efficiency will do, which is a great idea. However, the problem really is that the cost of electricity in New England and in New Hampshire in particular is really high compared to the rest of the country, and it's becoming an issue, an economic issue in terms of the where the New Hampshire economy is headed, in terms of attracting businesses, retaining businesses here, and that's why the energy issue has become like way at the top of the agenda of a lot of business groups, because they're very concerned about the supply of electricity, where it's coming from. The reliance on natural gas has required, as they see it, this need for a pipeline. And there's also, obviously, you know, there are other issues involving, you know, bringing hydroelectric from Quebec. But it's something that's really on the radar screen of a lot of people who are involved in economic development. So it's not just a matter of energy efficiency, because that's a longer term solution. They're talking about, we need something right now to lower the cost of our electricity.
That's what you're hearing from businesses,
yes.
Yeah, who are big users of electricity.
Absolutely.
Well, Sam, a couple last questions for you, please. Toward the end of the year, the company Kinder Morgan put forward a proposal for a natural gas pipeline that would run through more than a dozen communities in southern New Hampshire. Can you just give us a basic description, Sam, of that project?
Well, there's a lot of things we don't know still. For instance, we don't know how big they would actually build the pipeline, because there are a lot of unknowns for them as well. I mean, they have to sign up customers, and there's been this talk of would the pipeline be subsidized
through the regional electric rates of electric bill payers. And that's something that's never been done before. It was proposed by a committee that the New England governors put together. It's been sort of on hold. So we really don't know how many people are going to be signing on for this pipeline. But they've sized it anywhere from, you know, very small to all the way up. They said they can go as big as a pipe that's so big that it would eliminate the price difference between, you know, right in Pennsylvania at the Marcellus Shale and here. You know, so it's a huge range.
Wow.
Yes. But so we don't know how big it's going to be. The proposed route, though, goes under a PSNH power line right of way. And it's sort of usually, if you look at the maps, it skirts right along the edge. And it, you know, they'd have to bore it under a number of rivers and wetlands, you know, sort of the numbers that have been cited as in the hundreds of wetlands and rivers that it would cross through that they'd have to deal with. But, you know, it's just a massive project.
So it could take a while to get it built, Sam, given that you have to get permits to do all that work when you're going through wetlands.
The timeline, they were looking at sort of late 2018 to get it finished, if all goes well.
Okay. Well, Sam Evans-Brown, thanks for helping us out with this story and for all your help on the roundup this year. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
That's NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown. He's our environment and education reporter. Again, this is a special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking back at some of the top stories of 2014 with Jeff Feingold and Dean Spiliotis. And Dean, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the Pumpkin Festival in the city of Keene. The annual Pumpkin Festival, a beloved event, was marred by trouble at Keene State College. What happened?
Yeah, well, this has become a very big annual event. And as we saw, there was a lot of mischief and mayhem in the neighborhood surrounding Keene State. A lot of damage, almost riot style behavior. And it's really kind of called into question for the city whether or not they want to continue to do this or perhaps move it to another location away from downtown. But my understanding was that a lot of the mischief was kind of in a neighborhood a little bit away from the festival. And so there's been a really concerted effort by law enforcement officials to use social media to identify people who were involved. Keene State has held a number of kind of meetings and local summits to get input on what to do, and they've also disciplined a number of students as well. Next year is the 25th anniversary, which would be a great marketing opportunity for the city. And there are also some, there are some business owners who believe it would be a loss of an economic opportunity when you don't have that many people coming into downtown Keene. There are others who feel like it's not worth the hassle and the damage.
Well, there have been a couple of public meetings on this where people have been able to talk about how they feel about what happened, the future of the Pumpkin Festival. Here's Keene resident John DiBernardo. He's speaking about the Pumpkin Festival, how he feels about all this.
I don't blame the Pumpkin Festival for the violence that took place. However, I do believe that the Pumpkin Festival has achieved the status of attractive nuisance.
An attractive nuisance, Jeff Feingold, attracting people from outside New Hampshire even who just kind of want to create trouble.
Yeah, but I think it's obviously nowhere near as big as the Motorcycle Week, but if people remember not too long ago, that was considered an attractive nuisance as well because it, for a lot of people who were seen as undesirable. The interesting thing about the Pumpkin Festival is I remember being at the Keene Sentinel back when they had the Zucchini Festival in Harrisville, and somehow it became
The Zucchini Festival.
Yeah. And somehow people in Keene said, let's have a Pumpkin Festival. And it's been a great attraction for downtown Keene because Keene's got one of the nicest downtowns in the state. I think the worst thing about the Pumpkin Festival, if you want to call them the riots or whatever, was really that it made Keene look like it was not. It became a national story. It wasn't in the best light.
It didn't look good.
It was Stephen Colbert who had a piece on it, or John Oliver on HBO, and
it was just a year or two before that the HGTV had this big contest.
Yes.
About whether or not Keene could break a Guinness
record. Yeah, they
record.
Do try so every
it
year. Yeah.
It went from being a very positive story to a very negative
story.
Yeah,
it seemed to happen overnight. There would never seem to be any kind of problem before in terms of the students. And then when you think about it, the real thing is why it happened this year of all times. And the concern is, will it happen again next year, or was this a one-off?
Well, and just to clarify, I've got family and friends in Keene. They said, look, if you were at the Pumpkin Festival, you would have no idea this was going on.
That's the other
point. Sort of was happening down more close to the campus. But obviously, it's a big issue of concern. Well, I want to talk to you guys about another story that hit us just at the end of the year. This is one I felt personally. We're used to power outages in New Hampshire, but the one on Thanksgiving was a doozy. Jeff Feingold, the fourth or fifth biggest outage in state history?
It was just amazing. And I have to say, being in New London, I was shocked that we didn't lose power.
Yeah, because you guys usually do.
It was a Thanksgiving miracle.
What what made it so big?
The problem really was that it was a kind of storm that was just filled with heavy, wet snow. And it just brings down the power lines.
Mashed potato snow is what the utilities called it.
I think this is relevant. Is being in New Hampshire, in New London, we had the ice storm in 98, and we had another major outage. And because of that, they've done some really very radical tree trimming in our area, which I believe is which contributed to us not losing our power. But in other parts of the state, apparently, it hadn't been done, and that's really it's one of the effects of not keeping up with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think there are three big takeaways. The first is they've learned the importance of communication wherever possible. You know, I've been in the state for about 20 years, and 20 years ago, if we lost power, we just lost power and sat in the dark until the power came back on or the heat kicked back on. Now, I was out of town for Thanksgiving, hundreds of miles away, and I was able to monitor the power outage in my neighborhood on my iPad, and it was being updated every 5 minutes. So they've learned to use social media, to use technology, because information is a way to kind of keep people calm, basically.
Well, yeah, and that's actually an outgrowth. The communication with customers is an outgrowth of previous outages where they've been accused of not keeping people up to date, not responding right away. I know Unitil, which is based in New Hampshire, had some serious issues with their customers in Massachusetts a few years ago, where they become preventive. In terms of proactive, in terms of just working, reaching out right away and keeping people up to date what's going on.
Although it's harder to stay in touch when your electricity is out.
True.
And that means
it's good if you're
your phone
else,
is
though,
out,
right.
Both my cell phone and my landline were out because the landline is electrically run and the computer isn't working. So
not ideal, right?
Staying in touch is easy if you have a generator.
The other two issues are that these companies have made a real effort to refine the algorithm for these things. So they've started getting better at pre-positioning assets for post-storm. Yeah. And then the final thing, as Jeff mentioned, is this tree trimming, a lot more aggressive tree trimming around the state.
Well, we keep learning from these events, but we keep having them.
Yes, and we will have them. Let's not hope another one this winter, but you never know.
Well, no one's suggesting cutting down all the trees because they bring us many benefits for sure. A couple last questions for you, gentlemen. And I just want to say I really appreciate all the help that you've given us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup over the past year. It's just been terrific. Jeff Feingold, what was your favorite story to cover in 2014?
Well, actually, I really have to say it was something we talked about already. It was the Market Basket story because it was a feel-good story. It was, at the time, it was something changing every day, something going on every day, and it really the interest was amazing in this story. I know on our website, whenever we ran a story about Market Basket, we'd have a spike in our visitors and all that. It's something that people were interested in, and I think it was almost as if people expected the ending that happened. They were expecting
the
it was going to be a good ending.
Yes,
exactly. And I think I don't know what I want to think about what would happen if it wasn't ending like that. But it was something. It said a lot about how companies can succeed by working with their employees, by supporting their employees. The bottom line was at the very end, the day that Arthur T. DeMoulas took over ownership of the Market Basket for full ownership, he gave them over $40 million in bonuses to the employees. That's something that's really says a lot about the company, about his approach to supporting employees, empowering employees, and keeping them happy and loyal.
Well, and a lot of people, while this was going on, Jeff, I'm sure you remember this, said that this is going to be a case study in those famous Harvard Business
There's a discussion of doing a documentary on it. A movie, yes.
Okay. How about you, Dean? What was your favorite story of 2014?
I'm actually going to cheat a little bit and go with two, one political, one policy. Politically, for me, obviously, it's the midterms because that sort of election helps me get a read on where New Hampshire Hampshire is politically in terms of, you know, we had Democrats hold on in the big ticket races, yet Republicans make real gains in the state legislature. So it kind of gives me a nice read or an additional set of data points in advance of the 2016 presidential primary, which is going to be an increasing part of my attention.
Although, Dean, let me interrupt you there for a second. Yeah. It was kind of a limited read, though, wasn't it? I mean, not that many people went to the polls.
Well, sure. I mean, it was, as President Obama said, 2/3 of Americans didn't vote. But it's still another kind of set of data points for how New Hampshire performs under different political variables. So that was very important. The other one, I think, is energy. And, you know, energy is something I remember in the 70s in high school debating resolutions about energy independence. We had the oil and gas crisis. You know, we've had in New Hampshire the Northern Pass issue. We have the natural gas pipelines that Sam talked about. And we have all this stuff about wind power and site committees that are really critical to the economy of the state. So I think I've learned a tremendous amount of energy covering these stories over the last year.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Energy is not a story that seems to fall down on your usual political lines, right, Dean?
No, it doesn't. You see people on both sides of the issue, even on things like alternative sources. There are Democrats on both sides of the issue, and same with Republicans. It's funny because, you know, in national elections, energy tends to typically drop out of the top couple of issues, which are always the economy, healthcare, and foreign policy. But I think it's increasingly having a tremendous impact in New England, given that it's so cheap elsewhere that we would have these big issues with utility prices, I think is a concern for people.
So if I were to ask you, Dean, what are you looking forward to covering in 2015? Sounds like you would say politics and energy.
Electoral politics and energy politics in the state. It's one of the most interesting periods for energy politics that I've seen in quite a while.
Yeah, sure. And we'll be having a lot of presidential visits coming up very soon, I'm sure. How about you, Jeff? What are you going to looking at in 2015?
I do agree with Dean about energy being a major, major issue that I know we'll be covering in Business Review, but also just the idea of what economic development, because the New Hampshire economy emerged from the recession. It doesn't have this kind of diversity. It has the real strength it has in employment. We've got a low unemployment rate, but, you know, what are the jobs people are getting? And it's a concern of people, like, what is for the long-term economic health of the state? And it'd be interesting to see what goes on in the legislature next year to address exactly what those needs are.
All right. Well, guys, thank you very much for being here during this special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Jeff Feingold, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And Dean Spiliotis, thanks for your time.
Sure thing, Laura. My pleasure.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Joanna Albertson-Grove and Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Happy New Year to all. I'm Laura Kanoy.